Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Risk Map Podcast, looking ahead to the first 2 weeks of April 2014, produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. I'm Michael Moran, Vice President for Global Risk Analysis, based in New York.
And in London, I'm Nick Allen, Control Risks Regional Director for Europe and Africa. Mike, what's on our Risk Map radar this week?
A deal between Ukraine and the IMF should help plug a gaping hole in that troubled country finances. It'll officially be announced, we think, next week. Amid tensions with Russia over its absorption of Crimea, the troubles of Ukraine's economy have been overshadowed. But major economic reforms are demanded by the IMF in exchange, and that means risks of all kinds. A conference on the prospects of European shale gas opens in Paris on Tuesday, the 1st of April. We'll talk with Control Risks Associate Director Jonathan Wood on how shale gas might figure in Europe's efforts to wean itself from Russian supplies. Afghanistan selects a successor to Hamid Karzai on Saturday, 5 April, amid continued violence and a debate over corruption and the future of the U.S.-led military presence in the country. Corruption, along with slow growth in the emerging markets, hovers over important elections coming up in two of the world's largest democracies, Indonesia and India. In Indonesia, parliamentary elections on 9 April provide a preview of July's presidential election. And in India, a parliamentary and prime ministerial vote is staggered over more than a month, starting Saturday, 12 April. In both countries, a change of ruling parties appears imminent.
Thanks, Mike. Well, let's start with Ukraine. Next week, the IMF is expected to officially announce a deal to close a gap of some $15 billion in Ukraine's finances. With all that's been going on in Crimea, it's easy to forget that Ukraine has effectively been a financial basket case for years now. As you know, Mike, when the IMF gives money, it tends to attach conditions to it. So what's Ukraine expected to do in exchange for this aid?
Well, the IMF deal is expected to come along with the kinds of strings that we've grown accustomed to. Certainly far less spending by the state for things like subsidies on gas and other products. The Ukrainian currency over the years has been pegged to the dollar, and that's another issue. It has come down significantly. It's floating right now. The Crimea crisis knocked about 35% off of its value. This is something the IMF was demanding anyway. And so in some ways, the government gets a bit of a pass there. They don't have to do anything much to meet that particular demand. But that does make a lot of things more expensive to the average Ukrainian. And of course, you know, there is a general sense that Ukraine needs to open its sectors up to competition. So there's a lot to do, and that puts a new government in a very difficult position.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is whilst this is a short-term fix for Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, he is agreeing to terms that the ousted president, Yanukovych, actually refused to do. And what we saw there was he went into the open arms of Russia, who were prepared to give him some $15 billion without any of those economic strings attached, obviously political strings attached. I think in the medium to long term, there are going to be risks coming out of this because in implementing those IMF reforms, if you look at things like the price and the rise of gas, that's going to hurt people. And I just feel that this political crisis isn't over yet because if you're sitting in eastern Ukraine and you're sympathetic towards Russia and the Russian Federation, I think you're going to be feeling an economic squeeze in the months ahead. And looking across the borders to your compatriots, as you may see them in Russia, who aren't suffering the same way. So I think there's political risk on the horizon for a long time yet.
One of the many ways G7 nations would like to lessen Russia's leverage. That's right, we're back to G7 after Russia's suspension in late March from the old G8. Is to wean Western Europe from Russian supplies via the so-called shale gas revolution.
On Tuesday, 1st April in Paris, industry and national policymakers gather to assess whether such a revolution, one that's tearing through the United States right now, is feasible in Europe. The reserves are there, but what about the will? I'm joined by Jonathan Wood. So, Jonathan, there's been a lot of talk in the media in Europe and indeed in the UK where we sit today about this potential shale revolution. But there does seem to be quite a lot of local opposition. And do you see that holding back the exploitation of these reserves?
I think local opposition is certainly one part of the equation. There is quite a bit of support for developing shale and other unconventional oil and gas reserves in some European countries. In other European countries, some governments have come to power on the basis of their opposition to shale gas. And local community opposition has been a big part of that political dynamic. But it's also important to remember that some of the differences between the U.S. and Europe have to do with local property rights, the ability of local landowners to benefit from the extraction of these reserves, as well as the presence and cost of a deep, extensive oil and gas services industry that has the technology that's necessary to extract shale and other unconventionals.
But what about the Russia factor? So there's obviously a lot of tension at the moment being paid towards Russian foreign policy with the annexation of Crimea. We know that Europe and the European Union in particular, I think Germany often cited as very dependent on Russian gas and oil. So do you think that wish to find alternative sources of supply will get the shale revolution over the line, as it were?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We've started to see some political rhetoric that is referencing the crisis in Ukraine as a reason to extract shale gas. And this is probably coming most strongly from some countries on Russia's periphery, notably the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which are almost completely, if not entirely, dependent on Russia for natural gas. These are countries that have been trying to develop strategic energy security by diversifying sources of supply, so building LNG import terminals. They're now seeing potentially in shale gas and even further afield in Western Europe, shale gas is also seen as a way of reducing reliance on Russia, increasing diversification. And this is also coming to play in the U.S., where several politicians in favor of shale have come out and said the U.S. should be exporting natural gas to Europe to assist it with its energy security in this time of crisis.
And so, I mean, let's just talk a little bit about the U.S. and this shale revolution. Do you see it affecting, I suppose, U.S. international interests? There's talk that the U.S. will be less interested in the Middle East because they won't be so dependent on Middle Eastern oil and gas. Do you see that playing out?
Well, the energy revolution in the U.S. has certainly changed the U.S.'s strategic position. Even just 5 years ago, it was really a question about increasing imports, peak oil, and that debate is now really off the map. The question will be how the U.S. uses this strategic dividend of domestic oil and gas production. On the one hand, it's contributed to quite significant levels of investment in U.S. industry, so petrochemicals, aluminum, other energy-intensive industries have benefited from very low gas prices in the U.S. And then we've also seen the emergence of a lobby to export the U.S. energy revolution through LNG to both to Asia and to Europe. It's a big part of free trade negotiations that are going both in the Pacific and the Atlantic basins at the moment. And it will undoubtedly reduce U.S. reliance on Middle East, West African, and other providers of oil and gas.
So we really are in a time of change and flux. Jonathan, thanks very much. We'll leave it there.
Well, across the Asian continent this coming month, more than a billion people will be going to the polls in Afghanistan, Indonesia, and India in elections that will literally mark a changing of the guard in all three places. Let's start with Afghanistan.
Hamid Karzai has been in office since shortly after the toppling of the Taliban in 2001. His tumultuous term now at an end. There are some familiar faces leading the polls.
Yes, Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani, the former foreign minister Zalmay Rasool, and another former foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah, are some of the more familiar names on the ballot. Ashraf Ghani, in polls that are regarded as only somewhat reliable, seems to be the front runner. All of them, though, will be inheriting a country with enormous problems. They differ often on whether or not to engage the Taliban in peace talks, something that Hamid Karzai has pushed in recent months and to the ire of his American allies. They also will have to make the decision on how to engage the U.S.-led foreign military mission in order to reshape it for the years after 2014, when the U.S. and its allies in NATO and other nations have said they will begin to leave.
Yes, and it's hard, I think, to be that optimistic that democracy has really taken root at an institutional level in Afghanistan than what we've seen so far. But somewhere I think democracy really has taken root and in flourishing is in Indonesia, where a parliamentary vote on the 9th of April is going to reshuffle the country's legislative branch. But it's also going to provide an important test of strength for the man leading in the polls ahead of July's presidential race.
Yes, that man is Jakarta's popular governor, Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he's known, and he is the front runner right now to succeed President Yudhoyono, who has served out two terms and is prohibited from seeking a third. Jokowi has an interesting dilemma. His PDIP party is not one of the larger ones and must win at least 25% of the vote in the country, what that would be 20% of the seats in parliament, in order for the party to be able to nominate him alone as a candidate. Otherwise, he's going to have to go to some of the smaller parties and build coalitions. Finally, India's electoral carnival, lasting from 12th April into early May, kicks off with both parliament and the prime minister's post at issue. Also in the mix is a national debate on corruption and the slower growth that India has experienced in the past 2 years.
The Bharatiya Janata Party, more commonly known as the BJP, has been in opposition for over a decade now, and it looks almost like a prohibitive favourite, Mike. Its candidate, led by Narendra Modi, is governor of the highly successful economic state of Gujarat.
Well, the fact is not many currently doubt BJP will emerge as the single largest party in the 543-seat Lok Sabha, Parliament's lower house. Congress has been in power for more than a decade now, and the perception is that it has really run out of gas, and it has been hit by a string of really quite spectacular corruption scandals. Modi is a storied dealmaker, and his well-performing state of Gujarat has a reputation of being very business-friendly. So one of the questions here is you take the importance of corruption and you stand it up against a guy who is really regarded as a friend of the businessman. Can Modi do a kind of Nixon goes to China on corruption in India? I think that remains to be seen.
I think one of the interesting things, though, about Indian federal elections is, though, you might end up with a commanding majority and you might end up with your candidate as prime minister. But the history of Indian politics tells you that actually getting things done in a federal system where the states have such powers and really autonomy in certain areas makes the whole job a lot harder than it might seem, if it didn't seem hard enough already.
Well, I think that's enough risk for 1 week. That'll do it for this edition of our Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. The podcast is available every other Friday on iTunes or via our website, www.controlrisks.com. Also there right now is a webcast on corruption in Asia by Control Risks CEO Richard Fenning. It's timely, incisive, and a must for anybody doing business in the emerging markets.
From my colleagues in 34 offices around the world, this is Nick Allen in London saying goodbye.
And from New York, I'm Michael Moran. Until next time, so long.